I can say. Thank you. Okay. We're going to discuss Purim today. And, you know, for most people, Purim is not really that problematical. I mean, for many people, it comes down to this. what I'm going to try to show is it's a little more complex than just this, although this will be part of our discussion today. The fact is that Purim really raises many questions. The whole, already in antiquity, in the Middle Ages, and in modern times, it caused problems for people, both Jews and non-Jews. And at times, it was actually the cause of major confrontations between Jews and others. That's something we're not always aware of. First of all, the book of Esther is a problem. And how it made it into the Bible. Because you know what the problem is with the book of Esther? When yesterday I discussed the Haggadah, and I said it's all God and not Moses, Esther is just the opposite. No God. God is not mentioned at all in the book of Esther. You read it as a story that evolved. It happened by good fortune, by the foolishness of the king, by the wickedness of Haman, by the smarts of Mordechai, and the, the powers of Esther, the obvious powers that she had. And it's interesting that already in antiquity, people felt uncomfortable with that. And I don't know if you're aware of this. You know that all of the Bible was translated into Greek. It's called the Septuagint, Targum HaShivim. When those Jews translated the Bible into Greek, when they got to Esther, they did something very interesting. They cleaned up the act by inserting God. They added God to the book. And at the end of the book of Esther, in the Greek translation, there's the prayer of Mordechai to God. O Lord, who rules over all, for all is in your power, right? Blah, 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 blah. I refused to bow down to proud Haman, but I did it not to set the glory of man above the glory of God, but rather to recognize you and that you are the only God. Hear my prayer, have mercy on your heritage, and so on. They rendered it a good kosher book. And as if that were not enough, Esther also makes a prayer. Her prayer is kind of, you know, bad copy of Mordechai's prayer. What? Yeah, but Mordechai first. I mean, right. This actually may have solved it for some Greek-speaking Jews in Egypt. But the fact is that we don't really know if it solved it for many Jews in Israel for a good years. Do you know that in the caves of Qumran, where we found the Dead Sea Scrolls, we found fragments of every book of the Bible save one, the book of Esther. We have yet to find any fragments of the book. Raises a question. It could very well be that there were those groups who had trouble canonizing the book of Esther. And not only that, there are aspects, and we're going to get to this in a minute, in the book of Esther, that may have been troubling for people. Maybe at the time, certainly later. There are aspects in that book that people felt uncomfortable with. Yes, please.
And I one time was Rabbi Goldman and seminar, he brought another narrative of the Milah.
Yes.
And some of the facts that are narrated in that were totally different than what the Bible.
There are no biblical narratives other than, of course, the book of Esther, but there are slightly different versions that appear much, much later. There are sort of additions and almost midrashim. I'm going to allude to another book in a minute that is very reminiscent of the book of Esther. It's not the book of Esther, and it doesn't happen in Persia. It happens in Egypt. But the story is very, very similar. There was an evil king or a foolish king who was edged on by his henchmen to take some vicious action against the Jews, to slaughter them. He tries slaughtering them by congregating them into some sort of a stadium, and then he brings elephants that are to trample them. He gets the elephants drunk. Then what happens? Elephants, because they're drunk, they run the wrong way, right? He wakes up the next day forgetting that he wanted to slaughter the Jews. He's drunk. Very. One of his henchmen's name is something like Harman. Right? Sounds a little familiar. The scripture's there. To all the places where the king's decree arrived, there was all sorts of dismay and so on. You can hear the Book of Esther in the background, even though it's the Jews of Egypt that are celebrating. But we're going to see that there's a major difference between the two books, and I'm going to ask you about that in a second. But what was also disturbing to people in the Book of Esther, and if you look at the handout, I want to get to this immediately, was what appears at the very end of the book. After Haman's decree is abrogated, what do we read in Esther 9? And so on the 13th day of the 12th month, when the king's command and decree were to be executed, that very day on which the enemies of the Jews had expected to get them in their power, the opposite happened. And the Jews got their enemies in their power. The Jews mustered in their cities to attack those who sought their hurt. And the Jews struck at their enemies with the sword, slaying and destroying. They wreaked their will upon their enemies. You read that, you know, if you're a little sensitive, you might be a little uncomfortable with it. That doesn't cause discomfort. The next few lines almost definitely do cause, for some people, discomfort. Do you remember what happened? So they get revenge on their enemies, and then the king says to Esther, okay, are you satisfied? Can I do anything else for you? And what does she say? Source 2, if it please your majesty, replied, let the Jews in Shushan be permitted to act tomorrow as they did today. We want another day of slaughter. We didn't have enough yesterday. And the Jews in Shushan mustered again on the 14th day of Adar and slew 300 men in Shushan. The rest of the Jews in the king's provinces likewise mustered and fought for their lives. They disposed of their enemies, killing 75,000 of their foes. Right, wonderful. Okay. And as a result, you will find that there were both Jews and non-Jews who came away saying, this is very, uncomfortable for us. Let me read for you what a Jew and then a non-Jew had to write. This is not in your sources. I should have put it in, but we'll see in a minute. One of the leaders of Anglo-Jewry in the 19th century, Claude Goldschmidt Montefiore, an aristocrat, a very learned man, wrote an article in the Jewish Chronicle called, it's not before you, so you just have to listen, called Purim Difficulties. And he begins there with the statement, for those who regard Judaism as a religion pure and simple and the Jews as merely members of a religious brotherhood, a festival which lacks an inward and essential religious justification, because there is no religious justification, a festival like this presents serious difficulties and objections. Such a festival is poor. In other words, here's a Jew writing in the Jewish Chronicle, I don't know what to do with this holiday. It doesn't seem to expose, right, to project Jews the way I'd like to be. But of course, that was taken up by non-Jewish writers already in the Middle Ages. No less a personality than Luther, famous Martin Luther, has this to say about the Book of Esther, and I'm quoting. I am so hostile, he says, to the book and to Esther that I wish they did not exist at all. For they Judaize too much. Do you remember what happened to the Gentiles? They were all mityahadim. They start Judaizing for fear for their life, right? Says this book, and the book has much heathen perverseness. A well-known Bible scholar, at the end of the 19th century, Driver, writes the following. Much fault can be found with the temper displayed in the book of Esther. For instance, to breathe a spirit of vengeance and hatred without any redeeming feature, and to be further removed from the spirit of the gospel than any other book of the Old Testament. The gospel talks about love. This book of the Old Testament is as far removed as you can imagine. What's interesting is that that version that I alluded to in Egypt, called the third book of Maccabees, and it tells a story very, very similar to the story in the book of Esther, but it happens, as I said, in Egypt. Now look at your handout. Differs in one very interesting fact. What did the Jews in the book of Esther do at the very end when things turned upside down? They slaughtered their enemies. Who are their enemies? The Gentiles who wanted to kill them. Look at the third book of Maccabees, source number 3. On receiving this letter, there too, the Jews get a letter, right, from the king granting them their life. The Jews did not at once make haste for their departure, because what happened is they had all been rounded up in Alexandria, and now they're going to be sent back home again. But they didn't go home immediately. They requested further of the king. Now you have to understand what happened in the third Maccabees. There was a twist. There the king said, I want to slaughter all the Jews unless they agree to join the cult of Dionysus, that is, they become Hellenized. Then I won't slaughter them. And the story says that most of the Jews remained loyal to their traditional religion, but there were hundreds of Jews who gave in to the decree and crossed over to the other side. Look what the Jews in the third book of Maccabees asked. Requested further of the king that those of the Jewish people who had wittingly transgressed against the holy God and his law should receive due punishment at their hands. The king granted them full indemnity to destroy those who had transgressed the law of God anywhere in his dominion. And anyone of their countrymen that they encountered on the way who had become defiled, they punished and put to death as a public example. On that day, they put to death, now look at the number here, over 300 men, right? Do you remember the number 300? Where did we see it? In the book of Esther, in source number 2. So it's clear that he's borrowing from the book of Esther, right? But what is the difference? In the third book of Maccabees, whom did the Jews kill? They killed Jews. In the book of Esther, whom do they kill? Gentiles. What is better? What do you prefer? What are you more comfortable with? I'm asking this for a very definite reason. What are you more comfortable with? With the book of Esther or with the third book of Maccabees?
Esther, but I read the book of Maccabees.
It's interesting. I'm getting different responses now. Now, you say the third book of Maccabees. Why? But they're killing Jews here. Third book of Maccabees, the Jews killed the renegade Jews. And Esther, no, what you're saying is for Esther is relevant. He who comes to kill you, you can come and kill them. Right. So you're happy with Esther. We're doing it all in self-defense. Doesn't quite sound like self-defense when Esther says, give me another day to do some killing. It doesn't quite sound. Huh? Now you're getting political here. I don't want to talk politics. I'm not talking politics here. You won't suck me into that, right? Especially because Ari gives me 45 minutes and no more. Yes. That's 2 days. We're going to exactly what we're going to discuss 2 days from now. But I don't think so. The author of 3 Maccabees has the book of Esther in front of him. We can prove this without any doubt, right? But the author of 3 Maccabees is much more comfortable with having the Jews at the end, when they get the upper hand, kill their fellow Jews and not Gentiles. And you can almost figure out why this happened. Why the author of 3 Maccabees is much more comfortable with him having the Jews killing their own people. Yes.
Because 3 Maccabees is the Jews are, you know, not in the ascendancy, don't control their own
Take that further. Take that much further. The book was written in Alexandria or in Hellenistic Egypt.
Hellenistic Egypt, where there was a lot of social pressure against Jews.
Ah, In other words, well, I don't know if it's against Jews, but the atmosphere of the Hellenistic world was not conducive to writing books about how we killed a lot of Gentiles.
Right.
In other words, and this is interesting, in other words, the author of Three Maccabees is a lot more comfortable showing that Jews don't kill foreigners because they are foreigners, that at the very most, it's an internal issue, it's a family issue. Notice what these Greek Jews are doing. They're doing two things. On the one hand, they're rendering the Esther story more, quote, religious by throwing in God. Because then they say, at least this makes it a logically canonized book. But they're also more comfortable changing the end of Esther so that Jews don't kill Gentiles. Jews, better they should kill Jews, the renegades, the bad guys. Yes. Excellent.
Two-part question.
Okay.
And was there discussion to
canonize the Maccabees? Two excellent questions. First of all, clearly the Book of Esther was written before Three Maccabees because Three Maccabees is playing off the Book of Esther. In other words, the author of Three Maccabees is using it as kind of a mirror image, although he's moving the events to Egypt, but many of the events are very, very similar. I mean, when you read The Foolish King in Three Maccabees, this is Achashverosh, right? I mean, clearly, yeah. Now, we don't know. Second half of your first question is a very important question for which I don't have an answer, even though I wrote an article on it, right? And I still don't know the answer. I wrote the article, Artaxerxes, Achashverosh Xerxes in the Encyclopedia Judaica, which I wrote 35 years ago, and supposedly there I was supposed to tell you when Achashverosh lived. I still don't know when he lived, right? None of us really knows because we don't really know about the historicity of this book. I mean, this is a major problem. I'm not going to get into the question of the historicity of the book. But clearly it precedes, right, Three Maccabees by a definite period of time. Now, you asked another question, and that was? Right. We don't hear of any discussion to canonize the Maccabees. I will claim 2 days from today, that a book like 1 Maccabees might have tried to get into the canon because it was written in good biblical Hebrew, right? The author would have been very happy had it been canonized, as would have the Hasmoneans, right? But it never made it, right? It survived because the church, the church is the one, because it was in Greek in the end, the church actually preserved it. But we never preserved the book of Maccabees. That's a modern phrase. That's something we invented. It's not something that has a historical tradition to it, right? The books of Maccabees were not read by Jews in the Middle Ages. In other words, I can guarantee all of the people sitting in this room that, I don't want to say your grandparents, but I'm willing to bet that none of your great grandparents ever read the book of Maccabees, right? And I know all of you, but I'm willing to guarantee that none of your great parents read it because it was not a book that Jews read as such. It was not something that survived within the Jewish community. In the 20th century, when we retranslated it into Hebrew, it became a more popular book. And you can clearly imagine that with the emergence of Zionism, a book like the Maccabees would resonate much more because, we spoke about this, it was here 2 years ago, that the Zionist movement looked back at the Maccabees as being the heroes, right? Yes. It's an excellent question, an excellent question. The question was, why was the Book of Esther indeed canonized? God is not there, right? Well, I mean, the same question was asked by the rabbis already in the Talmud, and actually there's a debate regarding the Book of Esther, as there is regarding the Book of Song of Songs, a love song. What is a love song? An erotic love song in the Bible, right? There are questions regarding these books. Of course, the answer that the rabbi would have been giving is the Book of Esther, you could say, is probably the most important type of a religious book that one could read because it projects life as it really happens. Many of us encounter God in our lifetime. We encounter things happening, but we are told as good Jews, right, or as traditional Jews, you should interpret these events that are not manifestly divine. You should understand in them the hand of God moving things. So whereas the Bible, other than Esther, is God so obvious that it really require faith. He's there. He's doing things. There are miracles. Esther really requires faith. Esther is the one type of book that challenges you. You can either read God into it or not. In fact, somebody once asked a very good question, to which I, of course, gave an answer, right? Why is it that we say a beracha, we say a benediction on, that we don't say on Passover? When we read the Megillah, we say, Asher, God who sanctified us to read the Megillah, and then we say a bracha, which is She'asa nisim la'avoteinu v'yamim ha'im bezman hazeh, right? But we don't say it on Pesach. Why don't we say it at the beginning of the Passover Seder? He who did miracles la'avoteinu to our fathers v'yamim ha'im in those days at this time. Why don't you say it on Purim, you don't say it on Pesach? The answer is, I think, quite obvious. Yeah, that's why we say it on Chanukah as well. Both on Chanukah and Purim, one can easily interpret the offenses have nothing to do with Chanukah. On Chanukah, Maccabees were superior warriors and they were victorious. In Esther, God's name doesn't appear. And that's why you have to make a bracha. In other words, the whole point is to declare on those events where God is not manifest, you've got to say these were miracles that God, in fact, did on those days. Whereas Passover, it's one big miracle, right? Whether it's the plagues, whether it's the parting of the sea. In other words, you don't have to say it because the whole Haggadah is really a declaration of one big miracle. So that's the whole point, that Esther would be the challenging book, right? So I can understand somebody wanting to canonize it, but then, of course, saying, now you have to read into it all of these things. But not where I want to go today, so let's go. Yes. Well, but except that Esther doesn't have God blessing it. In other words, obviously what we're saying, or what Jews are saying, is we accept the Megillah as it is, right? Including, as you said, sanctioning God, killing these people. But it causes a problem, right? Nevertheless, they sound a bit bloodthirsty here. It's another day. Now, I really want to continue where we're going to wind up without time today. Fact is that Jews celebrated Purim in a way that also raised questions. It's not just the book of Esther. Think about it. So how do we celebrate Purim? Well, we get drunk, right? That's wonderful. And you can imagine we dress up. We have a carnival. Now, what do you know about carnivals in the Middle Ages and even in late antiquity? These were, if there's anything pagan in the ancient world, it's carnivals. And they were always linked up to all these pagan deities. So what's going on here? The book has a problem in it, right? The way it's celebrated is fraught with problems. In fact, Jews are selling, so it's kind of funny. In the book of Esther, what do? They kill Gentiles. And then how do they celebrate it? By behaving like Gentiles, right? by getting drunk, by having these carnivals, by having all of these masquerades. And by the way, this continues into modern times. I have here records of, right, I have a beautiful description here of the Purim balls that take place in the late 19th century in New York, right? The annual Purim balls were held in the largest auditorium of the city, such as Madison Square Garden and the Academy of Music. And you have here, nobody could enter unless they were dressed in a very particular way, very, very pagan, as it were. What's happening? Look at source number four, but not the first text, the Theodosian Code, but a French Protestant clergyman, Basnage was his name, who in the early 18th century describes how Jews celebrated Purim in late antiquity. Now, How does he know how Jews celebrated Purim in late antiquity? He's writing in the 15th century. He had one source. This is a source we'll read in a second. But he had something else. He had the Jews of his day. He looked and saw how Jews of his day were celebrating Purim, and he kind of imposed it on the ancient world, adding one fact that he had from the ancient world. Let's read this. The people, he says, being softly assembled at this feast of Haman, this is interesting, he says the feast was called Haman, committed 1,000 extravagancies. As they read the history of this enemy of their religion, the men and women made a frightful noise as often as the name of Haman was pronounced. In other words, here this fellow Basnach wrote a very serious book, claims going way back in history, Jews made noise when they heard the name Haman, which I suspect he saw and heard about for the first time when he went to the local synagogue. But he goes further. After the devotion followed the debauch, as is the custom of all feasts celebrated for some deliverance. Debauchery meaning what? Well, exactly, and drinking, right? And drinking also. The Christians took little notice of these follies. In other words, Jews would celebrate Purim by themselves. They'd get drunk, they'd eat, they'd make noise when Haman's. But then Christians noticed that something else was going on in the festivities. This is where it gets interesting. But the Jews used to set up a great gallows to hang up Haman's effigies. They would hang Haman. And 'twas imagined they designed to insult the Christians upon the death of Jesus Christ. In other words, they would hang Haman in effigy. But they knew that this really refers to somebody else. And perhaps this was true enough, for indeed they changed the gibbet, right, that's gallows, into a cross, and afterwards burnt the cross with the figure fastened to it, which was not done without maledictions, which reflected upon the Messiah we adore. In other words, what is he saying? That already in antiquities, the festival of Purim was celebrated by setting up a gallows and hanging Haman. But when the Jews hung Haman, they really thought about Jesus. Where is this coming from? Where does this come from? He's inventing this, but that's not to say that this actually happened. He had a source. The source was a legal code produced in the early 5th century. It was the Theodosian Code. This was a code of law that covers all of Roman legislation from the time of Constantine, from around 325 till about 425, the first 100 years of the Christian Roman Empire. And in that code of law, there is the following. This is the beginning of source number 4. The two emperors in Augusti Honorius and Theodosius to Anthemius the Praefectus Praetorium. Many of these laws appear as what? Emperor writing a letter to the local governor of a province, telling him this is how you should behave. And what is the letter about? The governors of the provinces shall prohibit the Jews from setting fire to Haman in memory of his past punishment in a certain ceremony of their festival, and they should prevent them from burning with sacrilegious intent a form made to resemble the Saint Cross in contempt of the Christian faith, lest they mingle the sign of our faith with their jest, and they shall restrain their rights from ridiculing the Christian law, for they are bound to lose what had been permitted them. In other words, they'll lose their rights that we gave them until now, unless they abstain from those matters which are forbidden. This is interesting. In other words, the law suggests that as early as the 4th century, Jews were doing something to Haman. But what were they doing? They were insinuating that it was anti-Christian. Now, you have to understand, where does this come from? First of all, there's a problem with how Haman was executed. Do you remember how was he executed? He was hung. Okay. Talu oto al ha'etz. The word hung is translated in antiquity and in our sources as well as crucified. And this is interesting. The word Hang is translated as tzlivat isa in Aramaic. Tzlivat isa, tzliva is a tzlav, is a cross, and it means to be crucified on a cross. So that a Jew who read in the Megillah was hung, and a Jew reading that when? In the third, in the Roman period, could easily imagine, right? And al what? He was hung. What does it say? Haman was hung al eitz. It says eitz. That's what a cross is. So a Jew could imagine that this is what happened to Haman. One, a gallows. Now, once you imagine that this is the way Haman was punished, and you on your festivities of Purim want to reenact what happens to Haman, what are you going to do? You're going to set up a gallows that looks like a cross. You're going to put Haman there. But your Christian neighbor going to automatically assume, what are you doing? You're basically hanging Christ. Yes.
But when we look, when Haman planned, wasn't he planned to hang Mordecai?
Also.
So how does it say?
Yeah. So when you read the Aramaic translations, the two words constantly interact. Tliva and Tlia, right? Constantly. Yes, the only problem is that nobody in Purim festivities ever hung Mordechai. Because how do you celebrate Purim? You celebrate Purim by hanging Haman, right? Just as you make noise, and so on. This, yes, please. Yeah, but, you have different translations. All I'm saying is that the word tala, right? In fact, you have cases in the Torah where it says if somebody has done something, it says in the Torah, Vitalita oto al eitz, it says, right? And that is translated in the Aramaic also very often, tsliva, as what we call crucifixion, right? Of course it was, but that's the point. When you're translating a text written in antiquity, but you're translating it in the third and fourth century, what are you going to do very often? And this happens with translations all the time. You're going to imagine what you're reading in the Bible based on a reality that you see in front of you today. In other words, and we do this all the time, whenever we look at the past, we always imagine the past in the image of the present. How do we dress Roman soldiers, right? Do we really know what they looked like? No, we dress them depending on who we are. If we were, you know, Spanish painters in the Middle Ages, we would dress them like Spanish grandees. If we were Italian painters, we would paint them like Italians, right? And that's what Jews are doing. But this became an issue. Look at the next source on the second page and to see how far this goes. This is a fellow, Ferdinand Gregorovius. Ferdinand Gregorovius was a well-known historian of the city of Rome. And he wrote a work, as you can see here, called The Ghetto and the Jews of Rome. It was written in the 19th century. Look at the way he writes. He goes much further than Basnach. And here you can see anti-Semitism already. Because remember, you realize where this is going to lead. Jews are celebrating Purim, and this is going to cause a type of anti-Semitism. I venture to suggest that the nature of the Hebrews themselves was responsible for the contempt equally great at all times with which Jews were regarded. In other words, first of all, he doesn't have any doubt as to where he stands. If people hate Jews, it's because Jews deserve it, right? And now he brings the example of why people hate Jews, why we Christians hate Jews. And what does he say, right? The Theodosian Code forbade the Jews in all the provinces to celebrate a certain festival at which they were accustomed to give sly expression to their hatred for the crucified Savior. Now you realize what he's doing here. He's reading into the law more than the law says. The law says that they were burning, you know, or they were hanging Haman in effigy, but he knows already that this is a sly reference to the Savior. This was the festival which commemorated the fall of their enemy, Haman. They represented Haman as crucified on that day, burned him in effigy amidst shouts and revelry as if he were the Christ. This was read by Jews. Jews read these things, responded. And responded. And it's interesting to see, how do you think Jews are going to respond? What will they say? They will say, no, not only was it acting, this is all in the minds of the Christians. They see what they want to see. Here you have fellow Donian, a Jew living in the middle of, in the early, first half of the 20th century, who wrote a book called Purim or the Feast of Esther, historical study. It was published by the Jewish Publication Society. Look how he writes about the very same issue. And now you see what historiography is all about. Right? About the commencement of the 5th century, Jews are said to have gone beyond the bounds of behavior of good citizens. In other words, you notice what he's doing already. He's tempering it a little, right? Haman was strung up on a gibbet and treated with every indignity. Meanwhile, their Christian fellow subjects could see in this nothing more than an insult to their religion. In other words, you see what he's doing? He's cleansing it. Jews never thought about Christ here. But Christians could see in this a reference to their religion and proceeded to attack the Jews that might thereby defend their faith. In other words, the Christians are evincing a defense of their faith. The peace of the Roman Empire was disturbed and the authorities intervened. By a law promulgated by Theodosius II, the law that we read, the public celebration of Purim was prohibited. In other words, what does this Jewish author say? Jews never intended to offend Christians. This is a Jew writing in the 20th century. However, the fact is, there were Jews in the 19th century and some very proud Jews who did not like Christianity very much. And these are the first generations of Jewish German scholars, some of them whose names I'm sure you know, one of the first great Jewish historians, Goetz, who wrote A History of Jewish People. Goetz was a very proud Jew, wrote his history in the second, Heinrich Zwi, right, Goetz, who wrote A History of the Jewish People. It was translated into English, by the way. Well, we'll get to that in a second. Huh? Oh, no. Wait. I'll get to that later. Look how Goetz wrote. Goetz, he's a little more ambiguous. On this day, the merry youths were accustomed to hang in effigy the archenemy of the Jews, Haman, on the gallows, and this gallows, which it was the custom to burn, had, by design or by accident, the form of a cross. Goetz is he's sharp here. I don't know if this was done on purpose or by mistake. Epis, it happened to look like a cross, and it got people all hot and bothered. If it were to stop here, that would be, say, okay, but it would be at least understandable. But it didn't stop here. This is the first stage of the phenomena, because it got much, much worse. Connected with Purim. Connected with Purim. Jews, for instance, we know that Jews who were accepting baptism in late antiquity, in the early Middle Ages, in some parts of the East, had to take an oath. And we have here part of an oath, and this was here on source number 5, where the Jew curses the Judaism that he's abandoning. I next curse those who keep the festival of the so-called Mordechai on the first Sabbath of the Christian fast, Lent. Now, this is interesting. I didn't go into this yesterday. Remember yesterday we were talking about aspects of Passover that remind us of Christianity. If I wanted to, I could discuss the whole question of the period between Purim and Passover. If you noticed it, what do we have about a month before Passover? We have Purim celebrated as what? As a carnival. Does that remind you of anything? Mardi Gras, right, exactly, just before the period of Lent. And then you have a month, right, leading up to Easter. And we have the same, we have Purim, and then we have a month leading up to Pesach. And what do we have in that month? We read certain portions of the Bible that talk about purification, right? One Shabbat where we read Parashat Parah, we read about the burning of the red heifer, which was a process of purification, etc. All of this has its equivalents in the Christian sense. But then he says, else is in this oath, I curse, and right, those who keep the festival of Mordechai and the first Sabbath of the Christian fast, the Lent, nailing Haman to wood, and then mixing with him the emblem of a cross and burning them together, subjecting Christians to all kinds of imprecations and a curse. In other words, Jews would be forced to curse the celebration of Purim because it was deemed to be an anti-Christian celebration. And if you want to become baptized, one of the things that Christians demand is you curse Purim. It's interesting. It was found in a text, and I gave you where you can read it in this fellow Thornton Journal of Theological Studies. We found this actually copied by certain Christian authors in the 8th century, in the 9th century. They repeat it, in other words, and this was published. It appears, it's quoted by a number of authors. But even more than that, a Christian author of the late 4th century, name is Socrates, who wrote a history of the church, tells the following story. At a place called Inmestar, situated between Chalcis and Antioch in Syria, the Jews were amusing themselves in their usual way with a variety of sports. In this way, they indulged in many absurdities, and at length, impelled by drunkenness, this is one allusion already to Purim, right, the drunkenness, they were guilty of scoffing at Christians and even Christ himself, in derision of the cross, and those who put their trust in the crucified one, now we go. They seized a Christian boy, and having bound him to a cross, began to laugh and sneer. But in a little while, they were carried away with their fury, and they scourged the child until he died under their hands. It's very interesting. We're always tempted to think about what? About blood libels happening when? Passover. Now you see that the season for blood libel begins not on Passover. When does it begin? A month before. It begins on Purim. And this continues. You don't have it in front of you. This, where Socrates says, this conduct, I'll read this to you, occasioned a sharp conflict between them and the Christians. And as soon as the emperors were informed of the circumstances, they issued orders to the governor of the province to find out and punish the delinquents. And thus the Jewish inhabitants of the place paid the penalty for the wickedness they had committed with this impious sport. This was not only in antiquity. A well-known author, who, and I'm sure that some of you have read this book and are familiar with the name, The Golden Bow by Fraser. Can you tell us something about it?
Yes, Sir James George Fraser.
Right. What do you know about the book?
Actually, it was a tremendously influential work back in the 20s.
Tremendously influential.
The Joseph of his time. He was trying to elucidate from various ancient civilizations common mythical structures.
No, mythical structures. He calls it the history of magic and the history of religion. He's looking for all sorts of origins to all sorts of ethnic behaviors in the ancient world, including Jewish. One of the things he addresses, by the way, is Purim. He talks about Purim. He talks about the origins of Purim. He looks for it in all sorts of Babylonian festivals. But then he says, this is 20th century, folks, and a well-known scholar. And he says that we learn, right, about the Purim behavior from the Theodosian Code. You don't have it in front of you. I should have quoted it, but this is strange. I was putting together these sources to email to Ari, and I could not find a copy of The Golden Bow in the Widener Library at Harvard. they were all out. I tried to order them so I could quote it, right? But I have it quoted here in front of me, but I wanted to quote it exactly. Books were taken out. But what does it say? He says that from an early time, Jews would burn or otherwise destroy effigies of Haman as part of the Purim rite. But then he goes on to suggest, I'm quoting, there are even some positive grounds for thinking that the Jews may at one time have burned, hanged, or crucified a real man in the character of Haman. Fraser writes, it's not impossible that it wasn't just an energy that they were, but it might have been a real person. But he goes even once, and he says, who knows, maybe Jesus himself did what? Spent time on the cross in the character of Haman. In other words, maybe we could, now that of course is way out, right? What is the point here? How you realize where Purim is taking us? In other words, it was something that resonated tremendously. Now, what I really find fascinating is look at source number 7 in the handout. Rabbis caught this way back in the Talmud. In the Babylonian Talmud, Tractate Megillah 7a, Rabbi Shmuel ben Yehuda said, Esther sent to the sages saying, commemorate me for future generations. In other words, she says, Kitvuni ledorot. Write down the events that took place now, the story of Purim, write it down for posterity. What did the rabbis answer back to her? They replied, you will incite the ill will of the nations against us. Who would have thought? In other words, the rabbis in the Talmud tell her what? Don't do it. We don't want to do it. Why? Because Purim will arouse the anger of the nations against us. Now, clearly the rabbis know something. In other words, they've already heard something. But you know what? She had the upper hand in the end. What did she write back to? I again foolishly cut it out here. What does it say in the Megillah? And these things were written, b'sifrei parshel, the Sifrei Hayamim, in the history books of Paras Umadai, of Persia and Media. So Esther writes back to the rabbis, look, you don't have to be afraid of commemorating this. Why? The Persians already have it in their history books, right? In other words, we won't be informants anymore. They know about this. So if they want to be bad to us, it won't be because of the Megillat Esther, right? It'll be because of what they want to do. And sure enough, Midrash alludes to these things. Look at Mordechai in source 8. Yesterday, Mordechai was ready to be crucified. Now he crucifies his crucifier. Right? There are all sorts of interesting allusions. Yes?
How far back was Purim celebrated?
We know about it being celebrated in the Second Temple period already. This was once a debate, but we know that there was a celebration in the Second Temple period. But when we get to the post-Temple period, we don't hear of any tension, as it were, about the celebration of Purim causing tension between Jews and Gentiles until the first centuries of the Christian era. But then we begin to hear that this is causing dissension. We hear of we don't have time. I'm going to skip over source 9. I want to go to source number 10 and again show you something. Yes, please. Yo, there were other sources. There was execution by the sword. There was execution. Huh? Yeah, it's very interesting. The rabbis don't talk about hanging the way we imagine it, with a hangman's knot. You know, the Mishnah in Tractate Sanhedrin talks about four ways of executing, and our system of hanging does not appear there, right? It's they understood it right as on.
Being on the cross was that?
Yeah, was that? In other words, by hanging on the cross. So it's easy to think about hanging Haman as having him crucified.
You don't want to die
immediately. Exactly. Yeah. Source number 10. This is an event that took place in the year 1192. And we know about it both because a rabbi by Ephraim of Ron wrote a poem, and we also know about it from Christian sources. And the story is as follows. Remember, O Lord, what befell us. This is the poem that the Jew writes. For we have gone from calamity to calamity. We have become weary without finding respite. A wicked Christian killed a Jew in the city of Bray in France. It's a question which city he's referring to. There are a number of cities that have a name very similar to this. Somewhere in southern France. The Jew's relatives came and cried out before the countess, although the murderer was a serf of the king of France, and gave her a bribe to hang this murderer. He was a Christian who murdered a Jew. They hung him on the day of Purim. Whereas the Jews were able to hang the murderer on Purim. The king of France heard this, that wicked king who had previously expelled all the Jews of his land in the year 1186 and taken all their money. That king, steadfast in his wickedness from beginning to end, he came to the city of Bray, commenced to burn the Jews, some of them very wealthy and as important as barons, some of them great rabbis, some of them advanced students. These Jews refused to sully themselves by denying the one Lord and were burned in sanctification of the unity of their creator. When does this happen? Now, this is the rabbinic description. But of course, people, it's always in the eyes of the beholder. The very same event is described in the writings of the biographer of the French king. And he describes the king reached the town called Bray and caused 80 or more of the Jews to be burned. The countess of that time, corrupted by the great gifts of the Jews, and handed over to them a certain Christian, whom they falsely designated a thief and a murderer. Moved by old hatred, the Jews led this Christian throughout the entire town with his hands tied behind his back, crowned with thorns, right, beating him. Subsequently, they hung him from a gibbet. Although they had said at the time of the Passion of our Lord, we are not permitted to kill anyone, right? In other words, we don't kill people, right? We can't do this, but they're doing. In other words, you see how different sides record the same event, depending on whose side you are. And sure enough, Gretz comes along in the 19th century and describes the event. And it's so honest at times. He can't deny things. By malignant design or accident, the execution of the Christian took place on the Purim festival. You notice the same language. what a surprise. It happened on Purim. And this circumstance reminded the people, now look how he writes, of Haman's gallows and perhaps of something else, right? And he's angling this in front of you, Gretz, right? Know what happened? In the subsequent translation of Gretz into Hebrew, and then in his later versions, they took that line out. You realize how sensitive it is. They didn't want to write perhaps something else, and so already the translator just said it reminded them of the evil king of France. And in Gretz's subsequent volume, right, in the third edition, all it says, the Jews were reminded then perhaps of Haman's gallows. Another great scholar of the 19th century, Leopold Zuntz, actually says the whole event was a mistake. And look at the last line on the page. These martyrs had simply gibbeted a figure of Haman, and the Christians thought that they were killing a Christian. This phenomena continues, this tension about Purim, until the middle of the 20th century. Turn to the next page. In a speech by Adolf Hitler, and it's amazing to see how in the Second World War, Purim suddenly became prominent again for all sorts of reasons. I can show you where, I don't know, is there anybody here from Habonim? Yes? Okay. Habonim in, here we are, in England in the mid-1940s issued a warning not to make noise during the reading of the Megillah. Why? And I'm quoting, this year the usual rattles must not be used. They are illegal because they are used as an important air defense signal, right? In other words, the noise sounded like the alarms, not to use the grogger or whatever it was that they were using. And all sorts of other allusions to Purim. These two are the most fascinating. Hitler, in a speech given by him on January 30th, 1944, and this is reported in the New York Times on January 31st of 1944, says, if Nazis go down to defeat, Jews would celebrate a second triumphant Purim. In other words, Hitler sees this Purim as being the ultimate, right, venting of Jewish hatred against Gentiles. And if we, the Nazis, go to defeat, there'll be another Purim. And sure enough, Julius Streicher, and you know who he was. He was the arch anti-Semite, the publisher of Stürmer, according to an eyewitness, correspondent, as he is being led to the scaffold for his last words, Purimfest 1946. In other words, you see what's happening. You have the history of this relationship. And Purim, you know, which we always thought to be this kind of very fine holiday of groggers, and a little drinking and a little carnival spirit, in fact, through the ages, had it carried with it a tremendous tension between Jews and non-Jews. And we have to be aware of this. This is part of Jewish history, no less than our, you know, carnival spirit. Purim, you know, which we always think of as the secondary holiday, probably resonated as much as Passover times in relations between Jews and non-Jews. It's something we kind of think is as being, you know, a secondary thing. But that season, from March till April, was always fraught with danger. Stop it. Now, I must mention something. I must mention, to be honest, much of what I hear was written by one of my colleagues in Israel at Bar-Ilan University in an article by Professor Elliot Horowitz of Bar-Ilan University. And again, I took a lot of information that he put together, and it was published in an article, in a article called Poetics Today. Poetics Today, volume 15. I would be dishonest if I did not quote him, right? Much material you can find in that article. I added a few things of my own here as well. Thank you.
Thank you all. Thank you. Well, we finished 2 out of 3, I guess, Thursday at lunch. We're going to take a Hanukkah story a little bit.
Yeah, this is the way you said it. Take apart, right?
Okay. Introduce new aspects of the Hanukkah story. And those of you coming tonight, don't forget 7:15 p.m. You need directions. You don't have a TV. And please support the CSP. You haven't signed up. There's a sign up sheet going around for Jeremy Dowell. But there's two things. One is his lecture on Sunday night. The other is a seminar or a private program where he's going to explore three of Isaac Bashevis Singer's most famous...
It's a fascinating aspect.
Yeah, it is.
Okay, thank you all. Have a nice day.
I forgot to mention what is so important. What happened on Purim in 1912?
Of course. Very good.
That's the Hadassah was founded on Purim of 1912. And that's why it's called Hadassah, because what was Esther's other name?
Hadassah.
Most important of
them. It was Henrietta.